This is PGI. Please stand by. We're about to begin. Good day, everyone, and welcome to the Genesis Oncology Trust Lecture Series. Today's call is being recorded. At this time for opening remarks, I'd like to turn the conference over to your speaker today, Dr. Melanie Lavelle. Please go ahead, Dr. Lavelle.
Good morning. Thank you so much for the invitation to speak from Rachel, and thank you to the Oncology Trust. I'm on slide 2 and moving now to slide 3. When I was deciding where I would speak to you from, given the fact that it's 5:30 in the morning here in Sydney, I did mention to Rachel that I might speak to you from home, but I was concerned about my dog barking. Rachel asked what sort of dog I had, so I thought I'd just show you. She's a puppy, and because she's so playful and somewhat noisy, I thought I'd better come into work and present from my office, and that's where I am. I'm a palliative care physician, and I did my PhD in educating people about cancer pain. I then had the opportunity to be involved in the Australian National Pain Summit as chair of the Cancer Pain and Palliative Care Working Group. I'm now working with a group to design an Australian guideline and an implementation strategy for evidence-based management of cancer pain. I work for Hammond Care and provide a palliative care consultative service with a team at a private hospital, the Mater, in Sydney. I do a clinic at Greenwich, and I'm a senior lecturer at Sydney University. Next slide. The work I'm about to present is a result of a large team's work, and I wanted to acknowledge the contributors up front. Fran Boyle and Phyllis Buto were the supervisors on my PhD and really started my involvement in this work, and I really am greatly indebted to them, and I continue to work with them on this. Professor Michael Cousins convened the National Pain Summit here in Australia, which is really in a response to a high degree of unmet need in pain, both chronic pain and cancer pain. Improving palliative care through clinical trials is the New South Wales Palliative Care Trials Group. It's funded by the Cancer Institute in New South Wales and is led by Associate Professor Mira Agar, who I'm sure many of you know, and Professor Trish Davidson, who has now moved to Johns Hopkins. Dr. Tim Lunkett is the program coordinator for IMPACT, and he has done an enormous amount of work in this project, and I'm extremely grateful to him. The Australian Cancer Pain Guideline Working Group, including Mr. John Stubbs, and I mention him because he is the consumer who has worked very hard both in developing the guideline but also in engaging consumers around Australia to get their voice and ensure that their voice is heard in this work. Cancer Council Australia hosts the guideline. Hammond Care and the other organisations there have provided funding. Next slide, moving to slide number 5. So just to give us a framework, I wanted to tell you the story of one particular young man called Lek, who I saw in clinic. He was a 35-year-old lawyer and martial arts exponent, and he came to see me in January, at which time he weighed 83 kilograms and was 182 centimetres, a very impressive figure of a man. He generously agreed to share his story as written by him, and he actually was very diligent in keeping notes about his illness, and these are the notes he read to me at clinic. He brought them on his iPhone. I have cancer of the stomach muscle, linitis plastica. It's inoperable, and with peritoneal metastasis. Diagnosed 1.5 years ago, had 6 cycles of EOX, then Xeloda indefinitely. I had 6 months, then a 6-week break, and then resumed. The last CT suggested metastasis may be returning. Also taking Nexium for stomach ulcers. He went on to describe his pains. Number 1, a sharp pain rated 5 and chronic along the top of the stomach when hungry or empty. It occurs every 35 to 45 minutes, leads to vomiting. Frequent eating helps. Fentanyl and or codeine reduces the pain scale and frequency. Occasionally starting taking codeine 2 to 3 times each night to help me sleep. Acute back muscle pain on the right lower back, started when commenced fentanyl, rated 6, chronic, lasted 2 to 3 weeks, and at present when I'm moving or stretching in certain ways. Number three, acute burning pain in lower stomach muscles near the area of both kidneys, rated 8, acute, sharp, burning, throbbing, similar to kidney stones when back pain subsided, present lying flat on back or sitting, leaning in certain ways. Gets progressively worse on days 2 to 3 of the fentanyl cycle. Need to sleep on side, and pain still presents 2 to 3 times each night, waking me from sleep, despite also taking the codeine and endone 3 times. This seems to lessen in intensity during the day, then returns in the evening and can be affected by exercise and retching. Number 4, acute strong pain across all stomach lining and muscles, rated 9, acute, has occurred 2 to 3 times for 2 to 3 days at a time. Seems to flare up from the muscle pain, intensified by hiccups, retching, and so far has settled each time. I'm currently prescribed 25 microgram per hour fentanyl patches, endone, codeine, osteo for breakthrough. Currently taking 37 microgram per hour patches, not enough or effective, and needing 3 to 5 breakthroughs each day and night. Breakthrough tablet strength only lasts 1 to 2 hours, then pain gradually returns. So Leg's history illustrates a number of points. Each person may have multiple pains, and it may be associated with multiple symptoms. It has a huge impact on sleeping, eating, ability to work. And also, I thought Lex's diary was a really good illustration of how important it is to keep track of what's going on, what triggers the pain and what affects it. Moving to the next slide, slide number 6. So this is Lex when he came to the hospital some 2 months later. He had a stent placed after our meeting, I think again illustrating when lots and lots of doctors are involved, different things are triggered by different doctors. This is an issue with cancer pain management. Since the stent had been placed, it meant that eating, which had relieved his pain previously, now exacerbated it, and he was a very unwell young man. So having painted that picture about some of the issues of cancer pain, we're going to talk a bit more about cancer pain in general, principles of cancer pain management, and then the main focus of the talk is the evidence in cancer pain management and how that has been put together in a guideline to help people manage cancer pain across the settings in which we care for people. So this includes general practice, it includes acute hospital, palliative care units, and so on. And then I'm going to finish with one more person's story. I just would like to note that the guideline is specifically for the Australian context, but I think almost all of it will be relevant in New Zealand as well. Next slide. Now moving to slide number 8. Adult cancer pain. Well, it's common in cancer. Remembering that one in five of the general population have pain, the incidence is more frequent in people with cancer. About one in three in an oncology clinic at any one time will have pain, and about 53% at any stage of disease will have pain, and it becomes more frequent as cancer advances. And some of it's moderate to severe, and when the pain is greater than 5 out of 10, this has a really significant impact on people's ability to enjoy life and every aspect of life, on the ability to walk, work, sleep, our relationships. The other really important factor is that it doesn't just affect the person, it affects everybody in their context. So care, stress and distress also increases as pain increases. Now, guidelines are available internationally. For example, the National Comprehensive Cancer Network guidelines, which are based in America, and there's several guidelines in the UK and in Europe. But nevertheless, internationally, pain remains undertreated, and study, very helpful meta-analysis by DeAndrea in 2008 showed that about 42% of people had inadequate analgesia. So in Australia, over the last 5 years or so, this has really been identified as a priority area by several bodies, the National Institute of Clinical Studies, the New South Wales Cancer Institute, and the National Pain Summit all identify this. So just an overview of the principles of cancer pain management, and I know that you are all very familiar with these principles. Screening for pain, just asking everybody at each contact whether they have any pain, and if so, if they're able to rate it. Now, many can rate pain on a 0 to 10 scale. Some find that much harder. I'm sorry, I didn't say next slide. We're now on slide 10. I beg your pardon. Then a comprehensive assessment for each pain, the cause and mechanism. Now, we're going to come back to assessment in more detail, but I'd like you to just spend just a few seconds now. I don't know if you have pen and paper. If you do, just jot down your own framework for assessing cancer pain, because one of the things that we all do all the time is assess people's pain. And many people have a quick framework that they think, okay, these are the five key areas that I ask about. But if you don't, that might be a nice outcome from this talk to think about your own framework, and I'm going to suggest one a little bit later on. So let's just take a few seconds to jot down your own framework for assessing cancer pain. Okay, the goal of assessing cancer pain is to think about what the cause is and what the mechanism is. In treating the cancer pain, it's always good to think about whether the cancer has optimal treatment. And, you know, that's not necessarily our role to offer anti-cancer treatment, but to ask ourselves the question, is everything being done? Because the best treatment for cancer pain is getting rid of the cancer, of course. Regular analgesia. PRN, if people have pain constantly, as Lek did, they need constant analgesia. The strength of the analgesia needs to be proportional to the severity of the pain, so strong pain needs strong pain relief. The prescription of breaks for analgesia. Now, in palliative care, this is core business, but it's not done in every setting, and so this is part of the guideline to reiterate the importance of this. And then titration of the analgesia so that people get the amount of pain relief which is satisfactory for them. The simplest regimen by the most convenient route, and prevention of side effects. So this is the framework that we are using. Next slide, moving to slide 11. So to address this issue of undertreated pain, a program of work was developed, and what I'd like to do now is describe to you the different steps in that program. I'm going to give summary of the findings of each of those steps and then show you the guideline itself. Moving now to slide number 12. It's been shown in the literature that there are three models of care that lead to improved patient outcomes regarding cancer pain, and one of them is the development of a clinical pathway. And so this is what our work aimed to do. And as you can see there were four main phases to developing this pathway. And I'm going to talk about each one of these. The first one that I will talk about, I'll just give you a list of them. It's the International Clinical Practice guidelines were synthesised and harmonised. There was a survey of current practice, which was actually an international survey, because very kindly a number of you will have participated in that. A literature review, where the gaps of literature existed. So just in 2011, the European Association of Palliative Care produced a really extensive cancer pain guideline. There was a whole issue of palliative medicine dedicated to their systematic reviews for a number of clinical questions. So we didn't need to do that again, but there were areas where the literature could be updated, and there's actually still gaps. But the two areas we focused on were patient education and the qualitative experience of people with cancer pain. So trying to get inside the experience of people with cancer pain and health professionals who manage cancer pain to really understand this better. And finally, a process mapping and environmental audit of pain practices, and I'll describe that in a little bit more detail. Next slide, slide 13. So the qualitative synthesis, now this, the idea of this was to catalogue the barriers and facilitators. And as I mentioned, we included patient health professionals and caregiver literature. We wanted to look at where those barriers and facilitators fit in the context of patient care and integrate the information at each of the levels at which care is provided to inform practical recommendations for improving implementation of evidence-based practice. Next slide, slide 14. So this is a rather busy slide, but I've included it because this is the framework we used for the qualitative review. It's a model of person-centred care, and as we thought more and more about it, person-centred care, I don't know whether in New Zealand it's also become a bit of a catchphrase, but it's in certainly in the UK and Australia there is more focus on this, in theory at least. And there were five dimensions of person-centred care as described by Mead and Bauer, and this is the biopsychosocial perspective, the patient as person, so the role the patient has in their own care, the doctor as person, so or more broadly the health professional as person, shared power and responsibility, and the therapeutic alliance. So they're the five dimensions. And so as you can see in this slide, there are lots of things that impact the final outcome of someone's cancer pain management. And if we're going to improve cancer pain management, it's not a simple thing. It's a complex intervention, and it does require input at each of those levels. So we need to look at the doctor level, the consultation level influences, the patient features, the how those come into play in the doctor-patient behaviour, and then the overall context, so the cultural, societal norms that impact on the practice of each of those things. So there is evidence that doctor and health professional attitudes, values, knowledge all impact on how they manage pain. The professional context is important, so professional expected norms, and then the accreditation and government policy. The patient factors, so their own attitudes and expectations, so whether they expect to have pain, whether they expect to have their pain control, whether they're afraid of analgesia, whether they're afraid of becoming addicted or the side effects of analgesia, their personality, their gender, the nature of their problems. And then, as I mentioned, the general shapers, their own previous experience. Next slide, slide 15. So the results showed they actually linked very closely. I should say that we ended up with 69 papers which covered those three areas of patient, caregiver and health professional. And we only included papers that had data from patients, so patient quotes or health professional quotes, so that we were really making sure we had strong literature. So the results were pain as a synonym for suffering. These were the themes that we elicited, that pain's more than a physical symptom, it's spiritual and social as well. So actually just targeting the physical symptom isn't enough. We need to be looking at all the other aspects that can impact the pain. Seeing the whole person, I think they're working very much with isolated parts of the body. It's as if they weren't connected. And, you know, that's one of our strengths in palliative care, that we do look at the whole person. But clearly from a patient perspective, often by the time they see us, they will have felt, you know, they may have had that experience that really there's just the cancer being looked at or the leg or not the impact on the whole person. Patients as experts on management of their own pain. Now, this is a really important area. And a patient said, sometimes patients know better than doctors what they need to have their pain under control. And I think we really need to listen to that. We need to listen to patients' own experiences and their own knowledge of their body and pain. And one of the things that we've worked towards, and I will describe in much more detail, is empowering patients to better communicate about their pain and better manage their own pain. Being believed, they don't know what I'm saying. They don't understand my pain at all. And therefore, it's made me feel that I'm lying, that I've been making a fuss about nothing. So making sure that patients feel trusted as they describe to us their pain experience. And then health professionals person. And one health professional said, I think that when nurses go into nursing, they already have an idea of what pain is because of their own experiences with pain. Next slide, slide 16. The next area of literature review was patient education, and we also conducted a systematic review and meta-analysis of randomised controlled trials of patient education interventions. The idea was to identify the effective elements of patient education because there's strong evidence, strong level one evidence that patient education does improve pain outcomes. But what we wanted to know was exactly what in patient education makes the difference. And we wanted to integrate that information at patient, provider and system level to inform recommendations as we did with the previous literature review. So rather than describe the framework and so on in great detail, we did use again a theoretical framework. This time we used Michie's framework of behaviour change, which looks at different elements of education and how they make a difference. We found that enabling elements were most helpful, and what that means is things that enables patients to better manage their own pain. Patient diaries, goal setting, scripts, and an individualised pain management plan. Next slide, slide 18. So the next thing we did was a national survey of current practice, because unless people in general felt that this was a need and that it was going to be of use to them, then we wouldn't have proceeded. So again, we wanted to look at barriers and facilitators to cancer pain management in the different settings in which people practice. We wanted to know which guidelines were in use and whether there was support for an Australian guideline and an implementation strategy. Now, we have a very, very good book called Therapeutic Guidelines Palliative Care, and that, as I'll show you, is used. However, it's not used a lot in oncology settings, that's where a lot of pain management happens. So this survey went out to peak bodies and meant thank you. If you responded to this, we had nearly 600 respondents, and we had strong support for an implementation strategy for guidelines. 47% were using an existing guideline routinely. Now, they might have been the international guidelines that I mentioned or therapeutic guidelines, but they also may have been their own institutional guidelines. The major barriers that people detected were lack of access to non-pharmacological treatment strategies, and that's often a funding issue that, you know, we know that psychologists and cognitive behavioural therapy can make a big difference to people with pain, but very few services have access to that. The next thing was lack of coordination across multiple providers, and this is key. People living with cancer and having it managed will often be seeing about 5 doctors, and if you add their background health problems, you know, that number increases. And when you're seeing that many people giving different advice, it makes a big it puts them at high risk. Next slide, slide 20. So the fourth and final part before we actually get to the drafting of the guideline itself was a project called the Stop Pain Project. Now, excuse all the different logos at the bottom, but I particularly wanted to include those because this work was led from the academic side by Professor Trish Davidson, and she is or was a professor at the Centre for Cardiovascular and Chronic Care at the University of Technology, Sydney. And the goal here was to develop and test methods to tailor implementation to the local setting. As you know, lots of guidelines are written and sit on shelves, and there's different reasons why their recommendations aren't implemented in different settings. And we wanted to work out a toolkit that we could tailor the guideline in different settings. And that was the purpose. So the first thing we did was an environmental scan, and this is an assessment of the internal and external factors that impact pain management. We looked at policy, workforce, funding, clinical practice complexity, and looked at a gap analysis. So it was, we were kind of almost using a business model. Then we did process mapping, and this is the environmental scanning is more of an eagle eye. This is a patient eye view of the system and processes, and this brought us back to the importance of our person-centred care. And it separates the experience and the management of an individual person's cancer pain into a series of steps, process of care. And it allows informing improvements by identifying ineffective or redundant steps. And this is fascinating because often when you're looking at things, you think there might be gaps, but there's actually often things that can be removed from the process of care that make it more efficient and more focused. It involves the local staff and therefore provides a real culture of ownership. Next slide, slide 23. How did we do it? We had in the right-hand column there a working group, and that involved many people from the site. It actually happened to be the site that I work at, Greenwich Hospital, and we had staff from all departments involved in this working group. We had clinical champions from each discipline and senior management. We also had consumers, patients and caregivers involved. We conducted focus groups and interviews with clinicians and with patients and caregivers. And we mapped the experience of 10 patients over 8 weeks. And from this, we developed dual patient and clinician cancer pain pathways. For the patient, it allows self-management and it helps identify, the real, when they come into problems with pain, what exactly they should do, who, how, what and when. All right, so the next phase is guideline development. Now, moving on to the next slide. Slide 25. I think it is helpful to go through the process of the development of the guideline because we all need to have confidence when we're looking at guidelines like this that's been a robust process. So we followed, and again, sorry that there's a lot of words on this slide, consulted with the NHMRC, which is the National Health and Medical Research Council here in Australia, and followed an ADAPT process. Now, we decided not to reinvent the wheel. If you're going to develop a guideline from scratch, then as the European Association of Palliative Care did, they define a number of clinical questions, and then you conduct a systematic review to answer each of those questions. Now, that had been done, and so what we did instead was use existing guidelines. We developed an organising committee and working group and then screened existing guidelines. And there were quite strict criteria. They needed to be English language, adult, chronic pain. In other words, there are guidelines available and there's a wonderful guideline in Australia for acute pain management, but that wasn't going to cover the whole picture for what we needed. It had to be relevant across tumour types, so not just in a single tumour, across disciplines and settings. Recent, so I think 2008 was our cutoff. They needed to be a national guideline, so not an institutional guideline, and rated as recommended or strongly recommended on the agreed criteria. So this is a further criteria where you go through the process by which they gathered their evidence. So we had 6 guidelines that we adapted, and we synthesised them, and we literally developed a matrix of recommendations for each clinical question, and where there was concordance between the recommendations and it fitted with the Australian context, we adopted those. If there were inconsistencies, we sent it out to an expert panel for adjudication, and we had expert panels for each of the areas, so one for adverse effects, one for pharmacological, and so on. So we then posted the guideline on the Australian Cancer Council website and set it out for public consultation. And that was a fascinating process. And we were delighted with the response. We had about 1,500 visits and 88 submissions to the guideline. And then we worked through those submissions and incorporated them where there was evidence to back them up. Next slide, slide 26. So the Australian Cancer Pain Guideline is at that address. It's on a wiki platform, which is a really exciting innovation in guidelines. It's a widely accessible, readily updatable guideline, which is available at the point of care. And the lovely thing about it is that people can view it, and in fact I had one person yesterday view it and send me a comment on evidence related to one of the points there. And so we have developed a process for updating it, but we can also just constantly get in new evidence to make sure that this is a up-to-date and relevant guideline. Next slide, slide 27. So this is a picture of it. Often what I do when I'm talking about this is have the website open on a different screen and we do a little tour, and of course that's not possible in this setting. But as you can see, it's easy to navigate. There's a menu which goes both down the screen and across the top in those icons. We talk about patient-centred care, screening, assessment, patient awareness and self-management, pharmacological management, non-pharmacological management, and then some advice on practice improvement and quality control, resources, opioid formulations, and the references. Now, this, as you can see, this public consultation bar there, there's two bars there that say submit new evidence or offer a comment, and so people can do that, and that comes directly to the working group. Next slide, slide 28. So this is the overview, and do you remember at the beginning we talked about the principles of cancer pain management? Well, this is just a little, algorithm for how we go about it, and it sort of summarises the points of the pathway. Now, when you're doing something like this, it often has to be narrowed down to a small number of things that are most important. I don't know if you've heard of the 80-20 rule, but you know, 20% of the effort gives 80% of the result, and this is what we aim for. And so when we're auditing the pathway, it's really a very, very small number of things that we're looking at, and it is the pain screened for? Is there a comprehensive assessment done and documented? Because this has been one of the big gaps, the documentation of pain assessments. Is regular analgesia commenced, breakthrough analgesia and laxatives prescribed? Next slide, slide 29. So do you remember I asked you to think a little bit about your own approach for assessing cancer pain? This is the one that we're using for auditing the guideline, and we found this was work that was done by the Victorian Palliative Care Network, really wonderful piece of work led by Odette Spright, where they did a comprehensive review of indicators, clinical indicators for pain, and some of you may have been on the expert panel for that. And they came up with a set of factors to audit, and these are the assessment factors. So precipitating and relieving factors, quality of pain and quality of life, So that includes the impact of pain on all those factors I mentioned earlier, walking, working, relationships and so on. Radiation site time course. Now these other questions are not in the guideline, but these are my favourites. Are you worried about something in particular? And that gets to the meaning of pain. So often people are worried about something that is really significant in their coping with their pain. And we need to have ways of getting to the bottom of what they are. And then Harvey Chochnoff has this beautiful question, which is so helpful. What is it important for me to know to care for you in the best possible way? And it is amazing what is uncovered by that question. So I've just added those two in because I think they're important. Next slide, slide 30. So evidence in pharmacological management. When this was done, and as I say, this was mainly done by the European Association of Palliative Care, although we did use the other guidelines as well, we looked specifically at these analgesics in cancer pain because people with cancer have differences in the way they metabolise drugs and the effect of medications compared to those without cancer. And so these are some of the points. High level of evidence for non-steroidals and paracetamol. Paracetamol is one of those fascinating, contentious agents that at present, high level evidence in mild pain. However, in addition to opioids, at the moment, not recommended as improving in addition to opioids. Moderate pain, low dose strong opioids or weak opioids like codeine. Our practice in Australia is to use the weak opioids less and less. However, the evidence exists that they work, and low dose strong opioids are comparable. In severe pain, the stronger opioids and morphine, oxycodone, hydromorphone, all good evidence for them. Fentanyl, however, in stable pain. An interesting recommendation, I guess I've been working in palliative care for nearly 20 years, and when I started, we always titrated with short-acting opioid, but the evidence shows that you can titrate with long-acting opioid with the addition of breakthrough. Next slide, slide 31. Neuropathic pain, firstly optimise opioids. Level 1 evidence for antidepressants and anticonvulsants. Now, NNT stands for number needed to treat, and NNH, number needed to harm. You need to treat more people to get benefit, and you need to, the risk of harm is greater than in non-malignant pain, so the number needed to harm is lower. So in other words, the therapeutic window is narrower in people with cancer pain. So these drugs do have side effects, and we need to be very cautious about our use of them and start with very low doses. Best evidence appears to be for gabapentin and pregabalin, and that's from the European guideline. Next slide, slide 32. In Australia, denosumab, Xgeva, is available for breast and prostate cancer. Important to add Zometa, but being aware of the impact on renal function and the risk of osteonecrosis of the jaw. Next slide, slide 33. Patient education. I can't stress enough how important patient education is in the management of pain. It is as important as analgesics, and it's been shown in clinical trials to be as effective. So often we measure the improvement in pain by pain scales 0 to 10, and the improvement with gabapentin, for instance, is 1 on a scale of 0 to 10. The improvement with patient education is 1 or more. So we should be thinking of it as an intervention in its own right, not an add-on, but a key intervention. As I mentioned, the self-management strategies are the important ones, and exploding the myths. Now, this book, Overcoming Cancer Pain, that's available from the Australian Cancer Council. It's also available online. It's evidence-based. It's been shown in a randomised controlled trial to improve pain outcomes. Now, that's now in its sixth edition. And for this most recent edition, we've included the findings of the literature review so that there's a little pull-out section at the back that patients can put in their own pain management plan, put in the people who they're going to contact, put in their own goals. So, for instance, a goal might be to sleep through the night tonight, and to put in their own diary so that they can keep track of what's going on with their pain. Next slide, slide 34. So non-pharmacological strategies that for which there are evidence these, and for a lot of them the evidence level is low, 3 to 4. However, for cognitive behavioural therapy and imagery, the evidence is higher. Next slide, slide 35. Just a list of references about this work. Next slide, slide 36. I couldn't give a talk on cancer pain without including this. Professor Likas was and is a fine palliative care physician, and this is her wonderful, simple way of reflecting how we manage this. Number one is the noxious stimulus. This is reducing the cancer, the anti-cancer treatments, the anti-inflammatories and so on. Number two, raising the threshold. This is, I think, probably the most important part of managing cancer pain. This is where we give people understanding, we give people confidence, we manage the associated symptoms, so make sure that people are bowels are working, that they're able to sleep through the night. We talk about and address the issues that are really of concern to them. Number three, analgesics, and number four, neuropathic pain, and I just find that such a helpful image. So finally, we're going to meet one more patient, and we're now moving to slide 37. So Stuart has mesothelioma, came to see me earlier in the year, and he was really in great distress. And all the people who come to see us in clinic complete a symptom checklist. It's now moved on a little bit from this one, but this is the SAS, that's part of the Palliative Care Outcomes Collaborative. And as you can see, Stuart was highly distressed. I often see these screening tools before someone walks in the room, and as soon as I can see nines and tens all the way down, I know that I'm dealing with someone who's really suffering. Stuart had significant chest pain. He was having a good response to low-dose opioid, and I was encouraged that he would get good relief with optimal titration. I thought there was a significant component of neuropathic pain, and I started an anti-neuropathic agent, and I encouraged the use of breakthrough pain relief. I asked him that question, is there anything else I need to know about you in order to care for you in the best way possible? And he said, well, I'm so glad you asked. And went on to talk about his fears of dying and his plans for the end of his life. He did have important upcoming events. His son was due to graduate in December, and he had a trip planned to celebrate his 27th wedding anniversary. So we started to talk about the fact that those things would be possible. And we started to redirect his attention from focusing on his death and the manner of his death to the things that he can look forward to. Next slide, slide 39. The following day, Stuart rang me and he said, I cannot believe it. My pain has all but gone. Later that week, he came to see me again, and you can see his symptom checklist has completely changed. Now, this relief wasn't because of the anti-neuropathic agent I'd started. It was because he had had all those threshold issues that I mentioned addressed. Yes, we followed the basics of the pain guideline, but we also addressed all those other issues. I'd like to finish there. I thank you for your attention, and I thank you for your interest. I thank you for your attendance at an early session.